This is Marcus Slayton and Christine Leffring with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. And here are tonight's headlines. Donald Trump will visit Waukesha next Wednesday. It's his first political rally since the start of his hush money criminal trial in New York, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This is Trump's second visit to Wisconsin this month. He stopped in Green Bay on April 2nd. His prospective opponent, President Joe Biden, announced a student loan forgiveness program when he visited Madison on April 8th.
Current election rules in Wisconsin stipulate that poll observers can't stand any closer than 3 feet from voters and poll workers. Some Republicans would like to narrow that distance, saying it's too far away for observers to see what's going on. The Wisconsin Elections Commission held a public hearing yesterday to hear comments on the distance rule and a number of others included in a draft of rules it's compiling for the upcoming election. Under state law, any person can act as a poll watcher, either representing a political party or a group, or just as an interested observer, reports the Capital Times.
More homes were on the Wisconsin real estate market in March than at the same time last year, but they weren't any cheaper. In fact, the median home price in the state was $299,900 in March, up from $272,500 in 2023. The median home price in Dane County, $430,000, up 7.5% from last year. The Wisconsin State Journal cited those numbers from the Wisconsin Realtors Association. The group said the number of homes on the market jumped 10.6% over last year, while sales rose 3.2%. According to Tom Larson, CEO of the Realtors Association, the strong demand for millennials is driving up sales and putting pressure on prices.
If you can't work in Disneyland, perhaps medical records at giant Epic Systems would be the next best thing. The company has broken ground on a new office complex called Other Worlds, which will draw architectural inspiration from The Lord of the Rings and The Chronicles of Narnia, reports the Capital Times. A key feature of the complex will be a so-called floating forest and a building called Elvendel, the mountain valley home of the elves, according to documents filed with the city of Verona. Meanwhile, one Epic employee told Tone Madison last fall, quote, "Realistically, our entire job can be very easily done from home," unquote. Epic Systems software manages the medical records of about 305 million patients and employs 13,000 people.
New Madison School Superintendent Joe Gothard wants to get an early start on managing the Metropolitan School District, he told the nonprofit Simpson Street Free Press. In an article reprinted in the Capital Times, Gothard said he pushed to start his contract next month instead of July so he can get up to speed with the interim superintendent and the Madison School Board. Gothard is a Madison native who previously worked as a teacher and administrator in Madison schools before advancing to jobs in Minnesota. He recently served as superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools, where he was recognized as State Superintendent of the Year.
Question: how can you tell a dedicated Santa Claus from a ho-ho-hum Santa? Answer: the beard is real. Just ask Jeff McMullen, a jolly old instructor with the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas. His commitment to the Santa craft has earned him a seat in the International Santa Claus Hall of Fame. Santa Jeff, a Wisconsinite from the Appleton area, will be inducted into the hall on Friday during the Real Bearded Santas conference in Memphis, the Appleton Post-Crescent reports. Where is the Santa Claus Hall of Fame? Well, at the moment, it's only in people's hearts and in cyberspace. But the Hall of Fame website says a new interactive exhibit is planned in Santa Claus, Indiana. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
The Federal Occupation Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA, was created 54 years ago Sunday, but construction is still a dangerous field. In the last year, 16 Wisconsin construction workers died from work-related injuries. A procession of construction workers walked through downtown Madison this afternoon to honor their fallen colleagues. WORT news producer Faye Parks was there.
Dozens of construction workers joined the procession through downtown this afternoon, wearing hard hats as a tribute to their colleagues who died from work-related injuries. They walked from the Monona Terrace to St. Patrick's Church for the 8th Annual Construction Workers Memorial Service. Rob Call, Executive Director of the Construction Business Group, created the event in collaboration with the Wisconsin Building Trades Council.
Workplace safety is a big issue for us, and so we started this memorial here in Madison, actually when I was in the state legislature, and I've come from working in this industry in this position, realized that we probably needed to do a little bit more to provide some outlet for members, families, and others to be able to gather together and mourn the loss of coworkers, friends, sisters, brothers, parents. That unfortunately happens in our industry. It's a very dangerous industry.
Construction ranks in the top 10 most deadly professions in the United States, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In the last year, 16 Wisconsin construction workers died from injuries sustained on the job.
It's too much. It's better than it has been historically, but it's still 16 too many. We keep striving for zero.
According to Call, falls and trench cave-ins are the main hazards in construction work.
You also have situations where more and more, especially in the transportation industry, people are being expected to work at night, obviously out in live traffic, and that is a huge danger.
But he adds that serious injury and death are avoidable when proper steps are taken. He says that OSHA's safety regulations are sufficient, but the agency often doesn't have enough staffing and resources to ensure compliance.
It really falls upon them versus our state agencies or local government to monitor and enforce those safety laws. I know there's a lot of construction sites, issues, et cetera, that they're not always able to get to simply because they don't have the manpower.
Call also says that construction workers and their contribution to society are often taken for granted.
We have this service to make sure the public understands what these men and women in the building trades are doing for them on their behalf every day. They're taking a much more serious risk of not coming home at night than most, if not all, other professions when you look at them in comparison to other professions.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
At a press conference this morning, Madison officials reiterated their preparedness for the annual Mifflin Street Block Party, scheduled for this Saturday, April 27th. Reporter Sarah Gabler attended the press conference and has the details.
Thousands of students attend the Mifflin Street Block Party every year. For some, it's a day of fun and revelry ahead of final exams. For others in the city, the event is a nuisance that promotes underage drinking. The event has roots in the Vietnam War protests of the 1960s, but its current form has many in the city concerned. In 2011, there were two reported stabbings, and in 2022, a balcony collapsed, injuring two people. In a show of preparedness, representatives from the Madison Police Department, Fire Department, and Building Inspection Division held a press conference this morning at Madison's South District Police Department. They say they're ready for the event this Saturday. According to Madison Police Central District Captain Mike Hansen, multiple groups have been canvassing the neighborhood.
For the last several weeks, we have been going to door-to-door with our PIO, our community police team, public health, building inspection, and talking to people about the safety of this event. And if people are hosting an event, what that looks like, what we look for, and how to stay out of trouble with the police department.
Other preparations have been ongoing for months, says Building Inspection Director Matt Tucker, whose division issued 24 notices of violation to building owners in the Mifflin Street area.
The majority of those notices of violation have been satisfied. They vary from as minimal as, fix the lattice that might have pulled off through weather over the winter to reconstruct your porch. We do have a couple that we're not sure are going to be completed on time. We're going to require those property owners to have those porches, decks, or balconies basically roped off, fenced off, or otherwise not occupied if they were unable to have the work done in time for the event this Saturday.
And Captain Mike Hansen wants participants to feel like they can approach law enforcement if they are sick, lost, or concerned about something going on.
Anyone that comes up to us and needs help, we're going to help. And then we can address their behavior, their drinking, or whatever later. The last thing we want is somebody to be scared to talk to the police or worried to talk to the police if there is something that we need to be alerted to.
He also cautioned partygoers to avoid using glass because it's banned or playing music too loudly.
We're not going to arrest our way out of this event and ticket everybody. That's not how it rolls. And we tell people, don't draw attention to yourself and don't draw attention to your party.
Given the block party's historical connection to political protest, one reporter asked about MPD's preparedness for a protest against the war in Gaza this weekend. Here's Captain Hansen.
The city is known for protests, so we're prepared. We've been monitoring the national events. We've met with other law enforcement agencies to at least discuss preparations, and they can pop up anytime, anywhere. We're certainly aware of that, and, you know, we'll assess as it, if it happens. We'll have to.
On Saturday, 150 officers and other partners from the Dane County Sheriff's Office and UW-Madison Police will be patrolling the block party. MPD will also take to the skies, using drones to surveil partygoers.
We know from a few years past that the backyards became unruly. There was property damage to some vehicles. There were some fights. It's such a great tool to be able to keep an eye above where the officers are at ground level. Now we can see where crowds are swelling and where people are coming from.
MPD has been using drones since 2017. Weather permitting, the estimated 10,000 folks attending the Mifflin Street Block Party will begin partying around noon this Saturday. For WORT News, I'm Sarah Gabler.
Have you noticed all the colorful polka dots painted on State Street? They're part of a new initiative to make the popular thoroughfare more pedestrian-friendly. WRT reporter Ella Staff has more.
Over 600 volunteers flocked to State Street this past weekend to participate in a community painting event. According to Madison City Planner Dan McAuliffe, State Street was painted in preparation for the summer and the start of the pedestrian mall experiment.
So what we have is a community painting event. So as part of our overall vision to help pedestrianize the 405 and 600 blocks of State Street, we are looking at adding some street furniture within the roadway as well as some placemaking items like street painting.
The painting event, officially titled #FlockToState, was organized in collaboration with five local artists who designed the large flamingo murals and stencils.
We put out a call for volunteers and we had over 600 people respond in 2 days. So we had a lot. You know, it's not every day you get to paint the street. I think that we underestimated the draw of that.
Volunteer painter Jan Hoffman came all the way from DeForest to participate.
Well, I came out to see if I could help paint this street, and it is looking beautiful. They had it organized as far as, you know, grids and panels of stencils for us to use. It's definitely going to be a place to come downtown and look at all the shops and browse, and, you know, especially people who've not been downtown before. I think it adds a lot of color.
Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Connor came to State Street to speak to volunteers and community members.
I mean, all the way along, people have been really excited about the prospect. You know, I think for decades, actually, people have had opinions about what State Street should be. And because we were running transit down it, we couldn't close it entirely. When we did the transit network redesign and took transit off of these three blocks of State Street, that opened up all sorts of possibilities.
On May 8th, the pedestrian mall experiment will officially begin. Starting at 3 p.m. on weekdays and 10 a.m. on weekends, the 400 to 600 blocks of State Street will be closed to all non-emergency traffic. As McAuliffe said,
the whole purpose of the pedestrian mall experiment this summer is to really take advantage of our great public spaces and bring our community together in those. And what a best way to kind of kick off this summer in on State Street than bringing the community together to paint some art.
Reporting for WORT Local News, I'm Ella Saff.
He announced a suite of rules that seek to reduce pollution from fossil fuel-fired power plants. Dr. Joel Charles, a rural family doctor, is the board chair of Healthy Climate Wisconsin a coalition of climate-conscious healthcare workers. He told WORT news producer Faye Parks that the new EPA guidelines are historic.
Thank you for joining me, Dr. Charles.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So to start, can you just walk us through the power plant pollution safeguards that the EPA announced today?
These really essential safeguards are, for the first time ever, looks to limit the amount of carbon pollution that power plants, existing coal plants and new gas plants, can emit. And the sort of basic structure of the Clean Air Act is, you know, we set standards according to what the best technology is that's available, and then we require power plants to meet those limits after a certain time, in this case in the early 2030s. So we're really excited about these rules.
And what are the consequences if power plants don't comply in that time frame?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, enforcement is like a big priority. I think mostly enforcement is delegated to the states. I'm not sure exactly what the penalties are, but they're big enough that the utilities typically follow these standards.
By your estimate, how will these new safeguards impact public health in Wisconsin? What is it preventing?
To back up a little bit, the Clean Air Act was passed in the 1970s, and we passed the Clean Air Act because we as a society decided that everyone, no matter where you live or how much money you make, that everyone has the right to breathe clean air. And we decided that as a society that if there's a technology available to produce electricity or power in a cleaner way, in a healthier way, then we should make sure that industries and utilities are using those technologies. And so that's the fundamental idea here. And over time, as the technologies have gotten better, the limits on pollution have become more stringent. And the reality is that burning of fossil fuels is really damaging for human health. Because we burn fossil fuels, Wisconsinites are more likely to have preterm birth, stillbirth, delayed cognitive development in children, asthma, adults get heart attacks, stroke, cancer, dementia. And there's really no one who's affected. From the moment of conception to our last breath, all of us are affected to one extent or another by air pollution from fossil fuels. And we've recognized that before in sort of what are called the traditional air pollutants like particulates and ozone. But now it's become clear that greenhouse gases are also a major threat to health. And so that's what the EPA is looking to do here, is to, for the first time, really set stringent limits on greenhouse gas pollution from power plants. And we think this is going to be a huge win for public health. The magnitude of the health impacts that we see in the population from fossil fuels is really significant. We think probably 1,200 lives are going to be saved in 2035 alone from this rule. That's probably going to be about $120 billion in health benefits and $270 billion in climate benefits. So a lot of people's lives are going to be better because of this. And that's all while pushing us toward a more affordable energy grid.
I noticed just recently that the EPA also announced guidelines for PFAS pollution in drinking water. So it seems like this is sort of a trend going towards restricting any kind of pollution that's harmful to public health. Do you find this encouraging? Do you think this will continue?
Yeah. You know, elections have consequences. And with the administration that came in 2020, there was a real valuing of public health. And so the Environmental Protection Agency over the last several years has been following the science and, you know, the values that our society set in passing the Clean Air Act, which is if there's a technology available to protect people, you need to use that technology. And so the experts, the scientists at the Environmental Protection Agency have been working very hard. And society, you know, regular folks, different groups have been, health groups, environmental groups have been weighing in and really pushing for protections for clean air and clean water. And our democracy is working. The Environmental Protection Agency is listening to people and doing their best to protect us. And that's the right thing to do.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion going forward about, I think you're going to hear a lot of pushback from utilities saying, oh, this is too fast, it's too stringent. Also talking about, well, we have booming electricity demand, and they're really going to be pushing to build gas plants and say, well, with these rules, we can't build gas plants. And the reality is, these rules are going to save a huge amount of money, and more importantly, they're going to save lives, number one. Number two is that we have the technologies that we need to meet growing electricity demand and do it in a healthy way, all while saving people money. But that does not involve building gas plants. The utilities want to build gas plants because their basic financial structure incentivizes them to build not necessarily the best option, but the most expensive option because they can charge their ratepayers the most for that. And so it's up to the public to hold them to account and push them to use the best technology. And these rules are going to help get us in that direction, but it's still going to require a lot of engagement from the public to make sure that, you know, groups like We Energies and others don't succeed at trying to build gas plants in their backyards.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Dr. Charles.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Dr. Joel Charles, co-founder and board chair of Healthy Climate Wisconsin. He says that the EPA's new limits on power plant emissions will save lives, but pushback from utility companies is a definite possibility.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Marcus Slayton, here with co-host Christina Leffering. Thanks for joining us.
In this archival edition of Transparency Talk, Jonah Chester talks with Tom Kamenick, president of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, about requesting public records from elected officials who have left office. A quick note that this conversation isn't specific legal advice, so seek an attorney's assistance if you have difficulty with open records or open government.
All right, it is every other Thursday, which means I'm joined on the other end of the line, as is tradition, by Tom Kamenick, founder and president over at the Wisconsin Transparency Project. Tom, how are you doing this week?
Jonah, I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I'm doing just fine and dandy. It is a beautiful, sunshiny day, and I am ready, as always, to talk open records and open government. And I'm really excited, Tom, because this week the topic was my idea. And we're talking about records of former office holders. Tom, let's start off today. What happens to records of former government officials who have left office?
So you want to start by looking at the record retention law, which is in the statutes. It's in the same chapter as the open records law, but it's really a whole different set of provisions. And one of the key ideas in that law is that the records belong to the office, not the officer. So they go with the position, not the person in the position. So the statute requires that when you leave office, you turn over everything to your successor.
Let's take a hypothetical example here. If I wanted records from the administration of Scott Walker, I would still file those with the Evers administration, correct? They would theoretically still have those records buried somewhere since it's the governor's office.
Correct. Records from Walker's time in office are still held by the office of governor. So you would make the request to Tony Evers. Now there's something called a public records board that sets forth specific timelines for how long records have to be kept. I don't know how many of the records from 2001 and the next 8 years are still in the office, but that would be the place to start. One little fun caveat with this is the law also requires a whole bunch of records to be offered to the Wisconsin Historical Society. So, and they kind of archive the most important stuff from government. And they don't accept every single piece of paper. They kind of have their own schedule of what they actually want for posterity.
Got it. So if I'm filing a record for like somebody who served in like the 1970s or 80s, I'd probably be better off just going straight to the Historical Society and checking in with their archives as opposed to going to the governor's office.
Yeah, they hold a lot. They have a central office in Madison in an old library building there, a very large old library building there. But they also have satellite offices, and a lot of the extensions around the state, the UW extensions, have archives of Wisconsin historical records for their area. But you start by going to the Historical Society and saying, you know, I want to see census records from the 50s or budgets from the 1920s and see what they have.
You know, for those of us who just like to spend our weekend perusing the state budget from like 1924 or whatever, prompted by no event in the news in particular, what happens if somebody takes the records with them when they leave office?
Yeah, so we're still talking about state officers, despite the allusion to Mar-a-Lago there. There does not appear to be a suit under the open records law to get those, because you can only file suit against an authority. That's the word that's used. And an authority has to be either a government office or an elected, currently elected official. Once you stop being the office holder, you can't be sued under the open records law because you're not subject to the law anymore. So that raises the question of, well, the person A was supposed to turn it over to their successor, person B. So can you sue person B? Can you sue the successor for those records that the original office holder took with them? Probably not, because the law says that authorities have to turn over records in their possession and they don't have them anymore. So what can you do about this? And the answer under state law might be not a whole lot. There is a provision in the records retention law saying that the new officer can sue the old one for any records they took with them, or the municipality or government entity can. So sometimes this comes up where, say, there's a sheriff, and the sheriff believes that the election of their successor was improper somehow, so they refuse to turn over the office, and they take their stuff with them. Well, the new sheriff could sue the old sheriff and get a declaration of who's really the sheriff now and get the records back too.
So a lot of ambiguity in this space. It's a case of like, state lawmaker, you make it off the Capitol Square. It's almost like Ollie Ollie Oxen Free. I'm out of here.
Yeah, it's illegal, but there's not necessarily a whole lot you can do about it. It's even harder probably if an employee, a former government employee, not an officer, but just a kind of rank and file front level employee, takes records with them, because they're not an authority under the statute about suing a successor suing their predecessor. That only applies to officers, not employees. There might be some kind of common law civil suit. There's something called replevin, where you ask a court to order somebody to turn over property that belongs to you if they have it in their possession. You might be able to do that, but I'm not aware of that ever happening. And it's be interesting to see what happened if somebody tried it.
Now, I wanted to touch a little bit on the Presidential Record Act, which we've sort of mentioned in brief in passing on the show before. But can you give me a background on that? What is the PRA?
Yeah, you have the same idea that the records of the presidency belong to the presidency and not the person who happened to used to be a president. It's not their personal property. It doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the office. If that idea goes way, way back, even to Britain, our former ties with them. You know, the queen or the king, the monarch, owns certain things in their office as monarch, but they also have separate personal possessions that don't flow to their successor necessarily. So FOIA itself, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, doesn't actually apply to the presidency. It only applies to to executive agencies. So the EPA and the DOJ and all the alphabet soup of agencies. But the Presidential Records Act does require the keeping of a lot of those presidential records, and it makes them available about 5 years after that president leaves office. So not immediately, but you're expected to be able to see them in the fairly near future.
So that is interesting, though, because there's like that connecting line between, you know, the state and the feds, where it's assumed, you know, the records aren't the individual persons, the records are the offices, whether it's the governor's office or the president's office, the White House, essentially.
Right. You're almost holding it in trust for the people, or at least for the next person who's going to have your office.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've come to the end of our show for this week. I've been joined on the other end of the line, as is tradition, by Tom Kamenick, founder and president over the Wisconsin Transparency Project. Tom, thanks as always for talking with me.
It's always a good time, Jonah. And remember, everybody, if you don't ask, you won't know.
Fishing season opens up in just a few weeks, but don't worry. There's still time to get out if you can't wait that long. Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg break down what's happening on this week's Fishy Business.
Alrighty, I'm on the line now with Pat Hansberg over at the DNS Bait Shop here in Madison. Pat, it's been a little rainy, sort of on and off over the last couple of days here, and it's looking like it's going to continue to do that going into the weekend here. But just sort of right off the bat here, what's the fishing been looking like around town?
The fishing's been good and getting better. Every day it seems like there's more and more folks getting out. It has been raining, it has been windy, but that hasn't stopped folks from getting out and enjoying the fine fishing we have in the area. The crappie bite downtown on Monona Bay continues to be good. Bass are moving up shallow. The catfish bite up here on the north side is actually turn on great. So, yeah, a lot of great opportunities to get out and fish.
And we are just about a week and a half away from fishing season fully opening up entirely here in Wisconsin. But we still have a little ways to go, and it looks like we might have some time this weekend to get out and fish if we want to do that. Hey, let's start going down the list. Lake Mendota, what's happening?
Well, we got a lot of fish up shallow, so the bass folks have been finding a lot of good bass action. If you can find any water that's, say, 5 feet or less, you're likely going to find some bass cruising around there. Maybe a walleye or pike in there, too. Of course, that season is closed right now, but there's still plenty of action with those fish. The catfish bite up at the 113 Bridge area and in the North Bay of Lake Mendota has been on fire. Those fish are getting ready to spawn, so they're bulking up for that. And yeah, a lot of good panfish action, too, in the same shallow areas where you'd find the bass, but more specifically in some of your protected inlets. So Marshall Park, Spring Harbor, University Bay, stuff like that are all holding good panfish. So, yeah, a lot of activity going on.
And I believe you mentioned Lake Monona a little bit earlier, just a little bit, but what's happening over there?
Pretty much the same thing over there. It's pretty much the same thing on all the lakes, really, but on Lake Monona, a lot of bass being caught up shallow now. And I mentioned the crappie bite over in Monona Bay and the triangles off John Nolan Drive there. It's been really good. Some good action in Lake Wingra for largemouth bass. A lot of small panfish in there, too, if you've got a young person you want to keep occupied. Also, the muskies. I hear the muskies are still hanging out below the Wingra Dam. So you can get over there and check those out. That won't last too much longer, but they are over there. So then on the just south of Lake Monona at Lattice Park in kind of, if you know, off the Beltline right there where Rutabaga Canoe used to be, is some good panfish action in there, too.
And you mentioned below the Wingra Dam. I know below the Wingra Dam at the moment is a protected fish refuge for the fish to spawn. Once May 1st hits, which will be before the next fishy business that we record, but on May 1st there, will that stop being a fish refuge?
Actually, I believe it's May 14th this year. I'm not sure what the rationale behind pushing it out. Usually those fish refuges open after the opener, which is May 4th, and so I'm not exactly sure, but I saw the signs down there, and it said either the 14th or the 16th, I can't remember, but a little later in May. So if you're going to fish down there, definitely check the signs and that are posted down there to make sure you're on the right side of the law there.
It's a good thing I checked. That is an important thing to know. And since we already touched on Wingra there, last lake that I want to touch on is Lake Wabisa. What's happening?
A lot of good panfish action in Upper Mud Lake, which is just north of Lake Wabisa. That's a large, shallow, kind of wide area on the Yahar River, if you want to call it that. And a lot of good largemouth bass in there. They're getting ready to spawn. But there's the dredge hole kind of on the east side of Upper Mud Lake, which is a deep spot in that that body of water. And a lot of panfish in there right now. So a lot of bluegills, a lot of crappies, a lot of great action over there for those fish. But down on Wabisa itself, I've heard about a little bit of panfish action in the Lake Farm area near on the north end of the lake there. But most of the panfish I'm hearing about are coming out of the south end of the lake in the South Bay down there. That's just ideal spawning grounds for a lot of fish. And so a lot of bluegills and crappies are kind of staging up down there in the 5 to 10 feet of water. And the bass are up shallow getting ready to spawn. So a lot of activity going on down in the south end of the lake there.
And now let's touch on a couple of the rivers. Starting off, let's hit the Rock River. What's happening there?
Well, the Rock River has been running very high lately. They got quite a bit more rain just to the south of Madison than we did. So last I heard, I guess it was a couple days ago now, but it was basically unfishable and they had no wake rules in effect down there. So I'm not exactly sure the status of that right now, but I know that the water has been high, which can make fishing difficult down there.
Then let's go to the other side of Madison and look at the Wisconsin River. What's happening?
Fishing on the Wisconsin River has been pretty great. The walleye bite over the last few weeks has been real good as those fish were kind of backed up at a lot of the dams doing their spawning rituals up there. That spawn is over now, and those fish have kind of migrated back downstream. whether it's to deeper holes in the river itself, or if you're talking about an area that's maybe near a reservoir like Lake Wisconsin, Castle Rock, or Peatonwell, those fish will move back down into the deeper lakes. But the good news is that while they may not be as easy to find, they are very hungry. They've been, you know, last few weeks focused on spawning, so they are hungry and looking to eat. So, great opportunities to get out and do some walleye fishing.
And the last thing I want to touch on, Pat, we're coming up on the full open trout season here, but you can still trout fish this upcoming weekend here. So what's the trout bite been looking like?
Trout bite's been good. Depending on where you're at, I guess there were a few streams that were affected by some of the rain, but as far as I know, they've all come back down into fishable levels, and there have been some good hatches coming off. Caddis have been hatching pretty regularly, blue-winged olives, a few stoneflies hanging around, but it's mostly a caddis and blue-winged olive thing. But on the spinning gear side of things, anything that imitates like a little minnow, works slowly through some deeper holes and deeper runs, definitely going to be a pretty safe bet for some action there.
All righty, Pat, and that'll have to do it here for today. Thank you again for talking with me this week. Remember, you can hear an updated fishing report just by calling 608-BIG-FISH. Pat, thanks again, and good luck out there.
Thanks so much, Nate. Always a pleasure.
Forward Madison FC are unbeaten four games into their 2024 USL League One season, and they're heading to Lexington this weekend to square off in the newly minted Jägermeister Cup. Andrew and Grant chatted to the Flamingos goalkeeper Bernd Shipman about the cup, as well as the talent and character in this year's squad. More now from Forward Focus.
Hello again and welcome to everyone listening to WORT online and at 89.9 FM on your radio dial. This is another edition of Forward Focus, a segment devoted to any and all things Forward Madison FC, Wisconsin's only fully professional soccer team. I'm one of your hosts, Grant Peters, assistant editor for cultural and Forward Madison theme magazine, New Dogma Zine. As always, the editor of NDZ and the producer of Forward Focus is Andrew Schmidt. When we last left you, FMFC was about to have their USL1 home opener at historic Bree Stevens Field against the rival Richmond Kickers in the season's first matchup of the illustrious Henny Derby. Derek Ebhard got the scoring started with a beautiful run into the box where he slotted it home to give Forward Madison a 1-0 lead. But Richmond would answer back with two goals of their own to take a 2-1 lead, but in the 72nd minute, substitutes Wolfgang Prentice and newcomer Augustin Davila linked up on a beautiful run of play to equalize the match and allow Forward Madison to come away with the point. FMFC still has one more match this season with Richmond, and that result will determine if the Henny Derby Trophy will once again make its home in Madison for the third consecutive year. Following that, Forward Madison took on the University of Wisconsin last Saturday in an exhibition match dubbed the Battle for Madison. Enduring the raw conditions of the weather and using the match as a way to get some players that don't always see the pitch some time, FMFC played their starters for the first half, but were unable to crack the UW defense. As heavy substitutions came out in the second half, FMFC again opened up the scoring after a blistering run by newcomer Sharif Dia, whose shot was saved, but Davila was there for the easy tap-in to make it 1-0 and gain his second goal in two games. UW would get one back late to tie the match, and from there it went to penalty kicks to determine the winner. Unfortunately, UW would outlast Forward Madison and take home the victory, winning 6-5 from penalty kicks. For this week's segment, the monster from Munster, goalkeeper Bernd Shipman, sat down on episode 48 of NDZ Live to talk about the rigors of travel in USL1 and how a healthy mix of competition and respect for each other is generating the club's mentality this season. Andrew, take it away.
So, Bernd, last year you played 33 games for the club, conceded 44 goals, but still tallied an impressive 12 clean sheets from those 33 games. You also saved 2 of 8 penalties, which is an excellent percentage. With all those sort of stats out there. Are you satisfied with last season?
Not really, to be honest. I think I had a pretty strong start. And yeah, as long as the season goes, I got a little bit tired, to be honest. Wasn't really used to it. I didn't play for a year before. So it was kind of like get back in the rhythm, strong start, and then the travel, turf every time and stuff like this. So I had to get used to it.
Is that a big adjustment, the travel by itself?
Yeah.
I mean, and
it's so underrated.
Was that probably like around like July and August?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I think after the Central Valley game, so I felt like, oof.
Because like that travel, that's right. Because like that 4-4 game coming back, you guys had a murderous travel coming back. Like you guys had like delay and like
it was like 26 hours or something.
Yeah,
like
to
that.
Get back.
Yeah, after this, normally I take like 1 or 2 days to recover, but I couldn't really recover fully. So that was really tough. So it kind of dropped my performance, I would say.
Yeah.
Still had some games. They were all right, but not like in the beginning.
What are your goals for 2024?
13 clean sheets, less goals against.
Yeah.
Love and it. Bring something home. Bring a championship home.
Yeah.
Definitely.
How big of a conversation is that in the locker room and with the other guys in the squad?
That's our goal. So we don't go to games and just, oh, we're going to tie, we're going to lose. Everything is focused on winning, and everything is focused on winning a championship. Yeah. Bring something home to Madison, yeah. Last week was kind of the first week where we had some time to work on some tactical stuff, because before I was always kind of in a rush. We had Tormenta, then Open Cup, Greenville, long travel day, Central Valley, long travel day, then we had Chicago and all those things. So, I think it's good to have a full week again to work on some stuff that we get everyone on the same page. And if we improve, we will improve, because we have the character in the team is this year really good. So we have intelligent guys, so we'll get there. We have this year a bunch of guys like Devin Boyce, Faraday Sosa, even Jake before, they won a championship, right? Then the guys from last year who experienced like this playoff game in Northern Colorado, they're hungry. They're super hungry. They want it more than ever.
Yeah.
And also, we have a huge acceptance inside the team, which is super important. We respect each other in a really good way, right? I'm a quiet guy. I don't say much, right? If I need to say something, I say it.
So come on our podcast.
Yeah. So if I need something to say, I'm going to say it loud and clear. But the guys respect it. Mm-hmm. Also, we respect our crazy guy Cheney when he's like shouting all through the hallway and stuff.
Who's
right?
always talking? Yeah.
Who's always talking? Yeah.
That's why we love him.
Yeah.
That's why we love him.
But that's, I mean, we have family, right? We see each other more than our family.
Yeah.
Right.
And accept someone and respect someone is the best way to have success.
Yeah.
If you know you have great individuals.
Yeah.
We have great players. They're all good.
Yeah.
They're all working hard. I think that's the thing, right? Is like you're able to look in that dressing room and know, despite a person's personality, how loud or quiet they might be, they're going to give everything they have.
Exactly.
Forward Madison FC is back in action this Sunday as they begin play down in Kentucky for the USL1's inaugural Jägermeister Cup, as they take on Lexington SC. Kickoff is at 3 p.m. and live coverage is available on ESPN+. Following that, FMFC will return home for USL1 league play to take on Greenville Triumph SC on Saturday, May 4th. Kickoff is at 5 p.m. and live coverage will again be available on ESPN+. And that will do it for this week. As always, we hope that you'll join us again as Andrew and I continue to keep you up to date on all the news, updates, and stories coming out of Bree Stevens Field as Forward Madison continues their quest for USL1 glory. For WORT, this has been Forward Focus.
And
That's a wrap for WORT's Live Local News at 6. Russ Mackey was your headline writer. Your reporter this evening was Sarah Gabler. Special thanks to feature contributors Jonah Chester, Dylan Brogan, and Tom Kamenick, Nate Wiegehout and Pat Hansberg, and the Ford Focus crew. Nicole Alley engineered the show. Welcome back, Nicole. Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Ms. Shali Pittman is the news director here at WORT. Thank you guys for listening. I'm your host, Marcus Lee.
And I'm Christina Leffring. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is the Perpetual Notion Machine. Have a good night.